welcome to the Search CRM podcast, Creating Customer Value with Peppers and Rogers. I'm Amanda Malgiri, assistant editor. In the December installment of our podcast series, Don Peppers answers questions from readers on building trust with customer strategy and customer equity in the short term and the long term.
The first question: my company manufactures steel pipes and we are known for our high quality products. However, our prices are higher than many of our competitors, and we are losing market share. How can we increase our market share without compromising on quality and losing customer trust? Which is a great question. It's a question a lot of companies ask. Obviously, quality is first. Quality of product and service, too. That's paramount. That's the greens fees for playing the game, really. But assuming that you have a quality of product and service that's at least on a par with your competitors or hopefully even a little better, there are a number of tactics you can use, and each involves increasing your own company's relative power in the relationship, its uniqueness, or its indispensability to the customer. In our experience, you should concentrate on tactics that fall into any or all of four general categories. One, customization. When you build a high-end customized service around the more commodity-like products or services you're selling, then you can create switching costs that increase the customer's willingness to continue to deal with you rather than bidding out the contract at every opportunity. Ideally, you'll lock the customer into a learning relationship where to get the same level of service somewhere else, he's going to have to reteach the competitor what he's already taught you. But sometimes very price-oriented customers will be wary of allowing you to develop that kind of a relationship. So the trick is to ensure that whatever high-end services you develop can only be duplicated by your competitors with great effort, even if they're instructed in advance. And you know what? Your toughest customers will instruct your competitors in what you're doing to try to duplicate it and bid your price down. Two, perpetual cost-efficient innovation. To the extent you can stay ahead of your customer with innovative product or service ideas, you're always going to have something to sell. Your organizational mission must center on being nimbler, more creative, more cost-efficient, all at the same time. But the value you are really bringing to the customer here is innovation, not the products themselves that are being innovated, but the act of innovation. Realize that many of your toughest, most price-sensitive customers, your big industrial customers, are going to do their best to absorb your innovation in order to try to do it themselves, or perhaps even to disseminate it to your competitors. They're going to tell your competitors so they don't have to pay your high price. But in either case, their motive is to regain their negotiating power, and so perpetual innovation is just that, perpetual. You can keep the wheel spinning. And if you can do that fast enough, then provided that you don't lose control of your costs, you can safely deal with these very tough, price-sensitive buyers. Three, personal relationships within the customer organization. In the end, of course, businesses don't have any brains. They don't make any decisions. Only people make decisions, and people are both rational and emotional by nature. Now, I used to tell people in the advertising business when I was trying to get new clients, you know, people are emotional. If people were totally rational, we wouldn't even have advertising. The individuals within your own organization, therefore, need to have personal relationships with the individuals within your customer's organization. And in your business, this might mean developing relationships with, you know, design engineers and others within a customer's organization who are responsible for using your steel pipes and whatever final products they're manufacturing, that kind of thing. Or it could mean trying to migrate up the organization chart at your customers so that your company can have a relationship with more senior people and penetrate the account more. And fourth, appealing directly to end users. You know, if you have a highly desirable brand or a completely unique product or a high-quality product that's in heavy demand by your customers' customers, then that's going to pull your product through your customer's organization more easily. That's the strategy behind Intel Inside, for instance, the advertising campaign by Intel to pull people to computers that have Intel microchips. And when Mattel offers Toys R Us an exclusive arrangement for particular configurations or products, that's the same kind of strategy. Any sort of information system or added service that saves time or effort for the end user can also be expected to put pressure on the customers to buy in. So if you can come up with a compelling reason for end users to demand your kind of steel pipes in their products, that will be a very, very powerful negotiating tool when it comes to maintaining your price. Second question. Should our marketing team be involved when defining and implementing a customer strategy? Why or why not? Well, you know what? I got a brief answer for this. This is an organizational question for your firm. And the answer depends entirely on how your company defines marketing. Now, we think, Martha and I think, that marketing really involves everything customer, everything. It encompasses service and sales and marketing, repairs, complaints. But there are many corporate organizations where sales, marketing, and customer service are split into several different departments, and yours may be one of them. It's basically a function of your company internally. There's no right answer to your question. Here's a question. I work in the media entertainment industry and need to calculate customer lifetime value. Can you give me some tips on how to do this? Well, yeah, we can. Lifetime value is the net present value of the future stream of cash flows a company expects to generate from a customer. Now, in your business, the first thing you need to decide is whether to concentrate on the lifetime values of the consumers of your media or the advertisers who probably pay a greater share of the bills. Either way, the actual value of a customer to a business can be defined and calculated in different methods, okay? Is lifetime value the net present value of the future stream of fully allocated profit from a customer? Or would it be more appropriate to talk about the marginal financial contribution of the customer? Or should we instead stick to our original definition of free cash flow? Each of these economic values has its advantages and disadvantages. However you decide to allocate profits and costs, we strongly recommend you pick up a book on the subject. Our own book, Return on Customer, has a number of sections and more than one appendix on the subject of modeling lifetime values and the changes in customer lifetime values that might be caused by your current actions. In other words, once you begin modeling lifetime values, what's really nearly as important as trying to get a fix on customer lifetime values to prioritize customers is to get a fix on what events cause those lifetime values to go up and go down currently, okay? If you can show, for instance, that a 1-point improvement in customer satisfaction is a 3% improvement in lifetime value, then you can monetize some of those non-financial metrics. And that, of course, would allow you to calculate your overall return on each customer. There's not enough space in a 15-minute answer. There's not enough space in an 8-hour answer to tell you how to calculate lifetime value. It's an academic subject, requires statisticians and complex mathematics, but it is not rocket science. It is not out of the realm of possibility for almost any business in business today with the data that's available. And when you don't have the data, you use your judgment and creativity, and you plug in proxy variables. We've written extensively about that, and we recommend not just our books, but other books. David Shepard has a terrific book on direct marketing that's got a lot in it about lifetime value. Question. We would like our customer service representatives to work on engaging customers emotionally to build customer equity and brand loyalty. How do you recommend they do this? Well, the biggest secret to this is to ensure that your employees are truly engaged in their own work. They need to take satisfaction in the work itself, and you can't simply command this through a particular organizational structure or a set of rules or processes. Your corporate culture, what your employees do when no one's looking, that's the primary driver of employee behavior. If your culture is based on acting always in your customer's interest, constantly trying to see things from the customer's own point of view, then you're at least halfway there when it comes to engaging customers emotionally as well. We suggest that to earn your customer's trust, you first have to earn your employee's trust. And employee trust is not always easy because hierarchically structured top-down organizations are just not well designed to encourage trust. part of what gets in the way of honesty and trust and openness within the ranks at many firms is the natural resistance that bosses show to opposition by their subordinates. You know, in a top-down organization, and almost all organizations are top-down, decision-making is placed in the hands of higher-ups, which, you know, is an implied recognition of their superior wisdom and leadership character. But people have a natural tendency to try to avoid conflict whenever possible, and bosses would rather not hear about problems, and subordinates would rather not have conflicts with their bosses. As a result, as everybody knows, as information goes up the chain in a hierarchical organization, the news gets better and better because information gets filtered in ways that's designed to minimize more the disagreement and trouble that bad news might cause. Now, add to this the fact that in the vast majority of companies, managers' incentive pay is based not on performance per se, but on performance relative to expectations or performance relative to plan. The performance versus plan system can easily be gamed. Students of incentives and budgeting processes have pointed out that when you set a target for a manager's performance bonus, you're really paying people to lie. Rewarding people for superior performance is a crucial management tool. It's an indispensable mechanism for improving your overall operation. But don't be deceived. Performance pay, especially when it's earned by individuals rather than by teams, it's almost always going to have a corrosive effect on an organization's sense of honesty, openness, and trust as well. Now, it may well be that the improvement in a firm's operational performance as a result of individual managers, you know, trying to achieve their own goals and make their bonuses, that'll be worth the cost. In most cases, it is. But unless you manage it carefully, performance pay can also work against a culture of trust, and that harms your desire to engage your employees and your customers. Despite the pitfalls, it is possible to manage your organization in such a way as to encourage the customer contact people to develop engaging and emotional relationships with customers, and truly successful firms do this. If you look at the relationships, for instance, that UPS drivers have with their customers, that's a great example. When you become a UPS driver, there's a whole gestalt of service created largely by the expectations of other UPS drivers. Rookies feel guilty taking a day off or getting sick and missing work. And that's the result of a positive corporate culture based on earning and keeping the trust of customers. So our rule is, if you want to earn and keep the engagement and trust of customers, first earn and keep the engagement and trust of your employees.
Thanks to Don Peppers for sharing his insight on customer strategy and customer equity. Be sure to join us next month for the next installment of our podcast series. Until next time, I'm Amanda Malgieri for Search CRM.